Socrates praises the sons of Ariston, inspired offspring of the renowned hero, as the elegiac poet terms them, but he does not understand how they can argue so eloquently on behalf of injustice, while their character shows that they are uninfluenced by their own arguments. He knows not how to answer them, although he is afraid of deserting justice in the hour of need. He therefore makes a condition, that having weak eyes he shall be allowed to read the large letters first, and then go on to the smaller, that is, he must look for justice in the state first, and will then proceed to the individual. Accordingly he begins to construct the state. Society arises out of the wants of man. His first want is food, his second a house, his third a coat. The sense of these needs and the possibility of satisfying them by exchange draw individuals together on the same spot, and this is the beginning of a state, which we take the liberty to invent. Although necessity is the real inventor, there must be first a husbandman, secondly a builder, thirdly a weaver, to which may be added a cobbler. 4 or 5 citizens at least are required to make a city. Now men have different natures, and one man will do one thing better than many, and business waits for no man. Hence there must be a division of labor into different employments, into wholesale and retail trade, into workers and makers of workmen's tools, into shepherds and husbandmen. A city which includes all this will have far exceeded the limit of 4 or 5, and yet not be very large. But then again imports will be required, and imports necessitate exports, and this implies variety of produce, in order to attract the taste of purchasers, also merchants and ships. In the city too we must have a market and money and retail trades, otherwise buyers and sellers will never meet, and the valuable time of the producers will be wasted in vain efforts at exchange. If we add hired servants the state will be complete, and we may guess that somewhere in the intercourse of the citizens with one another justice and injustice will appear. Here follows a rustic picture of their way of life. They spend their days in houses which they have built for themselves. They make their own clothes and produce their own corn and wine. Their principal food is meal and flour, and they drink in moderation. They live on the best of terms with each other, and take care not to have too many children. But, said Glaucon, interposing, are they not to have a relish? Certainly, they will have salt and olives and cheese, vegetables, and fruits, and chestnuts to roast at the fire. 'Tis a city of pigs. Socrates, why, I replied, what do you want more? Only the comforts of life, sofas and tables, also sauces and sweets. See, you want not only a state, but a luxurious state, and possibly in the more complex frame we may sooner find justice and injustice. Then the fine arts must go to work. Every conceivable instrument and ornament of luxury will be wanted. There will be dancers, painters, sculptors, musicians, cooks, barbers, tire women, nurses, artists, swineherds, and neatherds too for the animals, and physicians to cure the disorders, of which luxury is the source. To feed all these superfluous mouths we shall need a part of our neighbor's land, and they will want a part of ours. And this is the origin of war, which may be traced to the same causes as other political evils. Our city will now require the slight addition of a camp, and the citizen will be converted into a soldier. But then again our old doctrine of the division of labor must not be forgotten. The art of war cannot be learned in a day, and there must be a natural aptitude for military duties. There will be some warlike natures who have this aptitude. Dogs keen of scent, swift of foot to pursue, and strong of limb to fight, and a spirit is the foundation of courage. Such natures, whether of men or animals, will be full of spirit, but these spirited natures are apt to bite and devour one another, the union of gentleness to friends and fierceness against enemies appears to be an impossibility, and the guardian of a state requires both qualities. Who then can be a guardian? The image of the dog suggests an answer, for dogs are gentle to friends and fierce to strangers. Your dog is a philosopher who judges by the rule of knowing or not knowing. And philosophy, whether in man or beast, is the parent of gentleness. The human watchdogs must be philosophers, or lovers of learning which will make them gentle, and how are they to be learned without education? But what shall their education be, is any better than the old-fashioned sort which is comprehended under the name of music and gymnastic. Music includes literature, and literature is of two kinds, true and false. What do you mean? He said, I mean that children hear stories before they learn gymnastics, and that the stories are either untrue, or have at most one or two grains of truth in a bushel of falsehood. Now early life is very impressible, and children ought not to learn what they will have to unlearn when they grow up. We must therefore have a censorship of nursery tales, banishing some and keeping others. Some of them are very improper, as we may see in the great instances of Homer and Hesiod, who not only tell lies but bad lies. Stories about Uranus and Saturn, which are immoral as well as false, and which should never be spoken of to young persons, or indeed at all, or, if at all, then in a mystery, after the sacrifice, not of an Eleusinian pig, but of some unprocurable animal. Shall our youth be encouraged to beat their fathers by the example of Zeus, or our citizens be incited to quarrel by hearing or seeing representations of strife among the gods? Shall they listen to the narrative of Hephaestus binding his mother, and of Zeus sending him flying for helping her, when she was beaten? Such tales may possibly have a mystical interpretation, but the young are incapable of understanding allegory. If anyone asks what tales are to be allowed, we will answer, that we are legislators and not bookmakers. We only lay down the principles according to which books are to be written. To write them is the duty of others. And a first principle is, that God must be represented as he is, not as the author of all things, but of good only. We will not suffer the poets to say, that he is the steward of good and evil, or that he has two casks full of destinies, or that Athena and Zeus incited Pandarus to break the treaty, or that God caused the sufferings of Niobe, or of Pelops, or the Trojan War, or that he makes men sin, when he wishes to destroy them. Either these were not the actions of the gods, or God was just, and men were the better for being punished, but that the deed was evil, and God the author, is a wicked, suicidal fiction which we will allow no one, old or young, to utter. This is our first and great principle: God is the author of good only. And the second principle is like unto it: with God is no variableness or change of form. Reason teaches us this, for if we suppose a change in God, he must be changed either by another or by himself, by another. But the best works of nature and art, and the noblest qualities of mind are least liable to be changed by any external force, by himself. But he cannot change for the better, he will hardly change for the worse, he remains forever fairest and best in his own image. Therefore we refuse to listen to the poets who tell us of here begging in the likeness of a priestess, or of other deities who prowl about at night in strange disguises. All that blasphemous nonsense with which mothers fool the manhood out of their children must be suppressed. But someone will say that God, who is himself unchangeable, may take a form in relation to us. Why should he? For gods as well as men hate the lie in the soul, or principle of falsehood, and as for any other form of lying which is used for a purpose and is regarded as innocent in certain exceptional cases, what need have the gods of this? For they are not ignorant of antiquity like the poets, nor are they afraid of their enemies, nor is any madman a friend of theirs. God then is true, he is absolutely true, he changes not, he deceives not, by day or night, by word or sign. This is our second great principle: God is true. Away with the lying dream of Agamemnon in Homer, and the accusation of Thetis against Apollo in Aeschylus. In order to give clearness to his conception of the state, Plato proceeds to trace the first principles of mutual need, and of division of labor in an imaginary community of four or five citizens. Gradually this community increases, the division of labor extends to countries, imports necessitate exports, a medium of exchange is required, and retailers sit in the marketplace, to save the time of the producers. These are the steps by which Plato constructs the first or primitive state, introducing the elements of political economy by the way, as he is going to frame a second or civilized state. The simple naturally comes before the complex. He indulges, like Rousseau, in a picture of primitive life, an idea which has indeed often had a powerful influence on the imagination of mankind. But he does not seriously mean to say that one is better than the other, nor can any inference be drawn from the description of the first state taken apart from the second, such as Aristotle appears to draw in the Politics. We should not interpret a Platonic dialogue any more than a poem, or a parable into literal, or matter-of-fact style. On the other hand, when we compare the lively fancy of Plato with the dried-up abstractions of modern treatises on philosophy, we are compelled to say with Protagoras, that the mythos is more interesting. Several interesting remarks which in modern times would have a place in a treatise on political economy are scattered up and down the writings of Plato, CP, especially laws, population, free trade, adulteration, wills, and bequests, begging, Eryxias, though not Plato's, value, and demand, republic, division of labor, the last subject, and also the origin of retail trade, is treated with admirable lucidity in the second book of the Republic. But Plato never combined his economic ideas into a system, and never seems to have recognized that trade is one of the great motive powers of the state, and of the world. He would make retail traders only of the inferior sort of citizens, though he remarks, quaintly enough, that if only the best men, and the best women everywhere were compelled to keep taverns for a time, or to carry on retail trade, etc., then we should know how pleasant and agreeable all these things are. The disappointment of Glaucon at the City of Pigs, the ludicrous description of the ministers of luxury in the more refined state, and the afterthought of the necessity of doctors, the illustration of the nature of the guardian taken from the dog, the desirableness of offering some almost unprocurable victim, when impure mysteries are to be celebrated, the behavior of Zeus to his father, and of Hephaestus to his mother, are touches of humor which have also a serious meaning. In speaking of education, Plato rather startles us by affirming that a child must be trained in falsehood first, and in truth afterwards. Yet this is not very different from saying that children must be taught through the medium of imagination as well as reason, that their minds can only develop gradually, and that there is much which they must learn without understanding. This is also the substance of Plato's view, though he must be acknowledged to have drawn the line somewhat differently from modern ethical writers, respecting truth and falsehood. To us, economies or accommodations would not be allowable, unless they were required by the human faculties, or necessary for the communication of knowledge to the simple and ignorant. We should insist that the word was inseparable from the intention, and that we must not be falsely true, i.e., speak or act falsely in support of what was right or true. But Plato would limit the use of fictions only by requiring that they should have a good moral effect, and that such a dangerous weapon as falsehood should be employed by the rulers alone, and for great objects. A Greek in the age of Plato attached no importance to the question whether his religion was an historical fact. He was just beginning to be conscious that the past had a history, but he could see nothing beyond Homer and Hesiod. Whether their narratives were true or false did not seriously affect the political or social life of Hellas. Men only began to suspect that they were fictions when they recognized them to being moral, and so in all religions, the consideration of their morality comes first, afterwards the truth of the documents in which they are recorded, or of the events natural or supernatural which are told of them. But in modern times, and in Protestant countries perhaps more than in Catholic, we have been too much inclined to identify the historical with the moral, and some have refused to believe in religion at all, unless a superhuman accuracy was discernible in every part of the record. The facts of an ancient or religious history are amongst the most important of all facts, but they are frequently uncertain, and we only learn the true lesson which is to be gathered from them when we place ourselves above them. These reflections tend to show that the difference between Plato and ourselves, though not unimportant, is not so great as might at first sight appear, for we should agree with him in placing the moral before the historical truth of religion, and, generally, in disregarding those errors or misstatements of fact which necessarily occur in the early stages of all religions. We know also that changes in the traditions of a country cannot be made in a day, and are therefore tolerant of many things which science and criticism would condemn. We note in passing that the allegorical interpretation of mythology, said to have been first introduced as early as the 6th century before Christ by Theogenes of Rhegium, was well established in the age of Plato, and here, as in the Phaedrus, though for a different reason, was rejected by him, that anachronisms whether of religion or law, when men have reached another stage of civilization, should be got rid of by fictions, is in accordance with universal experience. Great is the art of interpretation, and by a natural process, which when once discovered was always going on, what could not be altered was explained away, and so without any palpable inconsistency there existed side by side two forms of religion, the tradition inherited or invented by the poets, and the customary worship of the temple. On the other hand, there was the religion of the philosopher, who was dwelling in the heaven of ideas, but did not therefore refuse to offer a cock to Aesculapius, or to be seen saying his prayers at the rising of the sun. At length the antagonism between the popular and philosophical religion, never so great among the Greeks, as in our own age, disappeared, and was only felt like the difference between the religion of the educated and uneducated among ourselves. The Zeus of Homer and Hesiod easily passed into the royal mind of Plato. The giant Heracles became the knight-errant and benefactor of mankind. These and still more wonderful transformations were readily effected by the ingenuity of Stoics and Neoplatonists in the 2 or 3 centuries before and after Christ. The Greek and Roman religions were gradually permeated by the spirit of philosophy. Having lost their ancient meaning, they were resolved into poetry and morality, and probably one ever purer than at the time of their decay, when their influence over the world was waning. A singular conception which occurs towards the end of the book is the lie in the soul. This is connected with the Platonic and Socratic doctrine that involuntary ignorance is worse than voluntary. The lie in the soul is a true lie, the corruption of the highest truth, the deception of the highest part of the soul, from which he who is deceived has no power of delivering himself. For example, to represent God as false or immoral, or, according to Plato, as deluding men with appearances, or as the author of evil, or again, to affirm with Protagoras that knowledge is sensation, or that being is becoming, or with Thrasymachus that might is right, would have been regarded by Plato as a lie of this hateful sort, the greatest unconsciousness of the greatest untruth. These, g. if, in the language of the Gospels, he who was blind were to say I see, is another aspect of the state of mind which Plato is describing. The lie in the soul may be further compared with the sin against the Holy Ghost, allowing for the difference between Greek and Christian modes of speaking. To this is opposed the lie in words, which is only such a deception as may occur in a play or poem, or allegory or figure of speech, or in any sort of accommodation, which though useless to the gods, may be useful to men in certain cases. Socrates is here answering the question which he had himself raised about the propriety of deceiving a madman, and he is also contrasting the nature of God and man, for God is truth, but mankind can only be true by appearing sometimes to be partial or false. Reserving for another place the greater questions of religion or education, we may note further 1. The approval of the old traditional education of Greece, 2. The preparation which Plato is making for the attack on Homer and the poets, 3. The preparation which he is also making for the use of economies in the state, 4. The contemptuous and at the same time euphemistic manner in which here, as below, he alludes to the chronic scandafrus of the gods. Book 3. There is another motive in purifying religion, which is to banish fear, for no man can be courageous who is afraid of death, or who believes the tales which are repeated by the poets concerning the world below. They must be gently requested not to abuse hell. They may be reminded that their stories are both untrue and discouraging, nor must they be angry if we expunge obnoxious passages, such as the depressing words of Achilles, I would rather be a serving man than rule over all the dead. And the verses which tell of the squalid mansions, the senseless shadows, the flitting soul mourning over lost strength and youth, the soul with a gibber going beneath the earth like smoke, or the souls of the suitors which flutter about like bats, the terrors and horrors of Cocytus and Styx, ghosts and sapless shades, and the rest of their Tartarian nomenclature, must vanish. Such tales may have their use, but they are not the proper food for soldiers, as little can we admit the sorrows and sympathies of the Homeric heroes, Achilles, the son of Thetis, in tears, throwing ashes on his head, or pacing up and down the seashore in distraction, or Priam, the cousin of the gods, crying aloud, rolling in the mire. A good man is not prostrated at the loss of children or fortune, neither is death terrible to him, and therefore lamentations over the dead should not be practiced by men of note. They should be the concern of inferior persons only, whether women or men. Still worse is the attribution of such weakness to the gods, as when the goddesses say, "Alas, my travail," and worst of all, when the king of heaven himself laments his inability to save Hector, or sorrows over the impending doom of his dear Sarpedon. Such a character of God, if not ridiculed by our young men, is likely to be imitated by them. Nor should our citizens be given to excessive laughter. Such violent delights are followed by a violent reaction. The description in the Iliad of the gods shaking their sides at the clumsiness of Hephaestus will not be admitted by us. Certainly not. Truth should have a high place among the virtues. For falsehood, as we were saying, is useless to the gods, and only useful to men as a medicine. But this employment of falsehood must remain a privilege of state. The common man must not in return tell a lie to the ruler, any more than the patient would tell a lie to his physician, or the sailor to his captain. In the next place, our youth must be temperate, and temperance consists in self-control and obedience to authority. That is a lesson which Homer teaches in some places. The Achaeans marched on breathing prowess, in silent awe of their leaders, but a very different one in other places. O heavy with wine, who hast the eyes of a dog, but the heart of a stag. Language of the latter kind will not impress self-control on the minds of youth. The same may be said about his praises of eating and drinking, and his dread of starvation, also about the verses in which he tells of the rapturous loves of Zeus and Hera, or of how Hephaestus once detained Ares and Aphrodite in a net on a similar occasion. There is a nobler strain heard in the words "endure, my soul, thou hast endured worse." Nor must we allow our citizens to receive bribes, or to say, "Gifts persuade the gods, gifts reverend kings," or to applaud the ignoble advice of Phoenix to Achilles, that he should get money out of the Greeks before he assisted them, or the meanness of Achilles himself in taking gifts from Agamemnon, or his requiring a ransom for the body of Hector, or his cursing of Apollo, or his insolence to the river gods Catnander, or his dedication to the dead Patroclus of his own hair which had been already dedicated to the other river gods Perseus, or his cruelty in dragging the body of Hector round the walls, and slaying the captives at the pyre. Such a combination of meanness and cruelty in Chiron's pupil is inconceivable. The amateur exploits of Pirithous and Theseus are equally unworthy. Either these so-called sons of gods were not the sons of gods, or they were not such as the poets imagine them, any more than the gods themselves are the authors of evil. The youth who believes that such things are done by those who have the blood of heaven flowing in their veins will be too ready to imitate their example. Enough of gods and heroes. What shall we say about men? What the poets and storytellers say, that the wicked prosper and the righteous are afflicted, or that justice is another's gain. Such misrepresentations cannot be allowed by us. But in this, we are anticipating the definition of justice, and had therefore better defer the inquiry. The subjects of poetry have been sufficiently treated. Next follows style. Now all poetry is narrative of events past, present, or to come, and narrative is of three kinds, the simple, the imitative, and a composition of the two. An instance will make my meaning clear. The first scene in Homer is of the last or mixed kind, being partly description and partly dialogue, but if you throw the dialogue into the ratio obliqua, The passage will run thus: the priest came and prayed Apollo, that the Achaeans might take Troy, and have a safe return, if Agamemnon would only give him back his daughter, and the other Greeks assented, but Agamemnon was wroth, and so on. The whole then becomes descriptive, and the poet is the only speaker left, or, if you omit the narrative, the whole becomes dialogue. These are the three styles. Which of them is to be admitted into our state, do you ask? Whether tragedy and comedy are to be admitted? Yes, but also something more. Is it not doubtful whether our guardians are to be imitators at all, or other? Has not the question been already answered? For we have decided that one man cannot in his life play many parts, any more than he can act both tragedy and comedy, or be rhapsodist and actor at once. Human nature is coined into very small pieces, and as our guardians have their own business already, which is the care of freedom, they will have enough to do without imitating. If they imitate, they should imitate not any meanness or baseness, but the good only, for the mask which the actor wears is apt to become his face. We cannot allow men to play the parts of women, quarrelling, weeping, scolding, or boasting against the gods, least of all when making love or in labour. They must not represent slaves, or bullies, or cowards, or drunkards, or madmen, or blacksmiths, or neighing horses, or bellowing bulls, or sounding rivers, or a raging sea. A good or wise man will be willing to perform good and wise actions, but he will be ashamed to play an inferior part which he has never practiced, and he will prefer to employ the descriptive style with as little imitation as possible. The man who has no self-respect, on the contrary, will imitate anybody and anything, sounds of nature and cries of animals alike. His whole performance will be imitation of gesture and voice. Now in the descriptive style there are few changes, but in the dramatic there are a great many. Poets and musicians use either, or a compound of both, and this compound is very attractive to youth, and their teachers as well as to the vulgar. But our state in which one man plays one part only is not adapted for complexity, and when one of these polyphonous pantomimic gentlemen offers to exhibit himself and his poetry, we will show him every observance of respect, but at the same time, tell him that there is no room for his kind in our state. We prefer the rough, honest poet, and will not depart from our original models.